Well, first, I want to say thank you so much for coming back on. I absolutely appreciate it. I know we had, oh, wait, we're not coming back on. You're coming on to my podcast for the first time. I was on your podcast last time. Are you still there? No, I lost you.
Just entirely froze.
Welcome back.
Literally, the second you start talking, my entire—I don't even know what the hell is going on. Okay, wait. I'm just gonna. My Wi-Fi has been weird, and I never have issues with my Wi-Fi. So let me. I'm just gonna exit out of everything that I have open so that I have as much space as possible, and then see if that helps.
Okay.
Okay. Let me try that again, and I'll hop my phone off of Wi-Fi as well because that might be part of it. Okay. Do I just start exactly from where you just started? Like
Absolutely.
just say everything over again, and then we'll see if it works.
Okay. Well, first, I want to say thank you so much for coming on my podcast. Last time I was on yours, and I know we had such incredible dialogue. That's why I really thought it would be important to have you on here so my audience had a chance to hear your insight and your story as well. I'm also really excited because this is episode 2 of the Shame series for August, which has been kind of a labor of love and a work in progress for a while now. So I'm really excited about that. So why don't you go ahead and give my audience kind of introduce yourself so my audience knows who you are as well.
Yeah, so my name is Fina. I am the host of Mindful Minds podcast, and then I started a blog called Serafina Blog. Actually, when I was really early in high school, it started as just like a diary for me trying to get some things out, and it kind of blossomed into this like platform that I ended up receiving feedback that people were really feeling heard and seen. And so I've put a lot of time and effort into trying to develop that. And then I hosted a support group over the years of, I think, 2018 to 2020 for college-age girls that were struggling with trauma and mental health, and called it Mindful Minds. And when the pandemic hit, there was no opportunity for us to continue that. We didn't really have the resources to do it virtually. And so for like a year after like the pandemic hit, I was just kind of like, gosh, I really miss that in my life. And I feel like we were making a lot of progress and people were feeling like they were actually receiving beneficial information. And it was a support group at a Christian college, but it had really nothing to do with religion. And instead of basically, I kind of started at a Christian college to get in the door. And then once everyone got there, it was like, hey, so we're not going to talk about God at all here. Like, we're going to talk about practical resources, worksheets, actual curriculum, and try to help you guys get some tools in your toolbox so that when you face these traumatic situations or you have triggers, you have resources to bounce back on. And I was so bummed that I had no way to continue it. And so I started Mindful Minds, the podcast, in April 2021 and decided, like, okay, well, let's just keep going through different topics of life and give people practical tools and information and resources as to how to either apply those to their personal life, or if it's something that they're learning about that they don't personally have a connection to, and maybe they just want to learn more about different diverse circumstances and walks of life. Give them resources and help them just figure out how to process and stuff. And so that's kind of how the podcast came to life. And then we talked about a bit on the episode on my side of it that I come from a really religious background. I grew up in a Christian environment from birth to like age 20. So I went to a Christian elementary school, a Christian preschool, Christian kindergarten, Christian middle school, Christian high school, Christian college. So it was essentially my entire upbringing. And the only gap I had in that was my junior and senior year of college. I did community college while being enrolled in high school. And that was my one little like dip into the outside world and outside of my bubble. And then I tried to hop back into Christian college at age 18, and it just didn't sit well. I'd already kind of had an exposure to the outside world, and trying to work my way back into a Christian environment just didn't seem to jive well with the way that my life was going and the way that I wanted to learn and grow. It just didn't really align. And so I've been out of Christianity for 2-ish years now, publicly, privately, probably closer to like 4 years. And a lot of my podcast kind of centers on helping people deconstruct from that and figure out how to cope with the trauma and the shame and kind of the long lasting effects that religion have on your life.
Long lasting effects.
long lasting. Yes.
Long lasting effects. It's wild how difficult it is to deconstruct from the indoctrination that occurs when you are submitted to that at such a young age with such intensity, which is why you're here today.
Yes, it is.
I'm actually really, really excited for my listeners. And this is actually going to be kind of a shared episode for those of you that are listening. Well, she'll have it on hers, her platform as well. We'll have our own intros and altos so that way we still kind of customize it to our audience. But I thought that this was just, I feel like this is going to be such a great episode that it would be, you know, beneficial for us to share with both of our audiences. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think both of our audiences probably share some level of, I guess, being able to resonate with the topic here. I know my audience, I expressed this to you like in the middle of our podcast, and our podcast shifted from talking about like poly relationships to then like a huge part of our episode was just like deconstructing religious trauma and shame, because so much of my audience is like really people who are brought up in a really conservative environment and either are kind of figuring out how to now cope with still being religious and now knowing more about the world and how to kind of marry those things, or people who left religion and are kind of like, hey, what the hell do I do now? Like, how do I come out of this? And like, how do I process? And so I'm going through that too. So everyone's kind of working through it together, and to some extent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I am years away from religion, years, like half my lifetime away from religion, more than half my lifetime away from religion. Wow. I don't like thinking about numbers. And I am still battling some of that internal dialogue that makes me feel shame, you know, in so many different ways. Especially, I feel like I've gotten over a lot of the shame, but I think the narrative that I still struggle with the most is really around like my sexuality, just sex in general, and kind of the shame that goes with that. I'm doing way better than I used to, though, like way better. But it takes time. It takes so much time.
Yeah.
When you...
Yeah, that was a...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. yeah, that was a big processing point for me as well, was obviously a lot of people who grow up in religion have a very conservative like sexual upbringing as well, where it's a lot of the purity culture, it's a lot of the shame, it's a lot of the sex is only for marriage. And that was something that like I think I was privately processing and kind of unpacking unknowingly from age like 13 to like 17. And then funny enough, when I kind of started to like actually enter sexual relationships, it flowed really easily, because I think I had been unpacking it for like most of my childhood to some extent without really realizing that I was doing that.
You're so lucky. You're so lucky. Yeah, that is not.
I think it's a unique experience.
Yeah, it did not work out like that for me. I carried, unknowingly, I carried that shame associated with sex for most of my adult life up until literally just a few years ago, because I guess I just never even tried to unpack it. It was something that, since in my family, it was just something you didn't talk about, I just chose not to think about. Mm-hmm. So I stuffed it.
Yeah. Which I think is fair. I think a lot of people take the kind of dissociation route of just like entirely checking out mentally from it, which I think is part of the reason why so many people that struggle with sexual shame and religious trauma also really struggle with pleasure. Because when you disassociate from your mind and like the processing aspect, once you actually get into a sexual relationship, even if that is in marriage, like even if you're married and you stayed a virgin your entire life and like you get married and you have sex, sometimes the actual connection to your body, you're so tapped out mentally and you're gone. Like you're not connected to your body. You're not grounded in your body. You can have sex and still experience like vaginismus and have like pain while in having sex, or have discomfort or headaches, or just not really be able to actually be present in the moment and not really be able to experience pleasure or orgasm and all these different things. It just kind of becomes something where even if you really truly stayed true to that like religious doctrine of I'm going to stay quote unquote pure, I'm going to be a virgin, I'm going to save it for marriage, you can still get to marriage and still be fucked up by it. Like it really does depend on, I guess, how much it messes you up personally. But even if you stay within religion, it can still have like long lasting damage aside from the unpacking part of it. Cause like the actual trying to like process it or like leave it and exit the religion and then engage in some sort of sexually liberated environment, that's a totally separate thing. But if you're still in the religion, like that can still really mess with your mind on top of everything else. Which also, am I good to cuss? I realized I didn't ask that.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Really, I was like, I've dropped the F-bomb once.
We hold nothing back on my podcast. Feel
fair free. Fair enough. But yeah.
And I can absolutely agree with that, because even when I was in my mono relationships and I was a serial monogamist, I struggled with getting erections for most of my relationships. Like when we were in the heat of new relationship energy, NRE, I could maintain it then. But the moment that it fell into like a comfortable long-term relationship, it was reliable and dependable and comfortable, I had a really hard time expressing love sexually and emotionally. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know if that's because that's just what I witnessed, was that like my family never expressed affection really. I mean, it was very, very, very minimal. So in my mind, like a good partner was a provider and a caregiver.
Right.
And a support system. So it was like, for me, once we established relationship and it was like we were coupled, we were moved in, the sexual side had to disconnect and I had to fall into a new role. And I just could not merge the two. And for most of my long-term relationships, I couldn't manage an erection. So it was,
And I've heard that from a lot of people, and I've heard from the side of it for like having a vulva or having a vagina. Like there are a lot of people who experience vaginismus. I experienced vaginismus early on in a traumatic relationship, because I think the other side of not getting, enduring sexual shame is if you're in a situation where you're experiencing purity culture, you're experiencing the long-term damage that comes with sexual shame, you're also often not given proper sex education. And so a lot of times, and even statistically, like not being given proper sex education often then can contribute to sexual violence, because you're not educated on consent. You're not educated on boundaries. You're not educated on how to say no, what is appropriate in a sexual dynamic, what is healthy, what is not healthy. And a lot of times, if it's not like a brutal sexual violent situation that you see in a movie where it's like you were forced and like, or you're like, if it's not super aggressive and blatant, a lot of people, it goes over some people's heads, including mine. Like I was in a really pressure filled, coercive, manipulative relationship. And I was experiencing vaginismus constantly. Anytime we would do anything sexually. Yes.
I, just because other people may not know this, because I don't know this, what is that term that you're saying?
And what, yeah, so vaginismus, I am, so it, I'll look up the actual definition, because I don't want to create a definition just out of my own personal knowledge of it, because I feel like there's probably a better definition out there. So from NHS UK, vaginismus is the body's automatic reaction to the fear of some or all types of vaginal penetration. When penetration is attempted, your vaginal muscles tighten up on their own. You have no control over it. Occasionally, you can get vaginismus even if you have previously enjoyed painless penetrative sex. And so it's a literal anatomical reaction to having a fear over sex. And that can stem from sexual trauma. That can stem from fear of sex because of sexual shame, where you're afraid that God's going to come down and smite you. There's a lot of different causes. Some of the ones that they list is like anxiety disorders, childbirth injuries, prior surgery, fear of sex, or negative feelings about sex due to past sexual abuse or trauma. And then there's the actual symptoms. You can have discomfort or pain during vaginal penetration. You can have painful intercourse. You can even have like pain while inserting a tampon because your body is like so like not okay with something entering you. And then I also experienced, like, in my personal opinion, vaginismus also can come with like kind of psychosomatic symptoms as well. So I would have like headaches and I would feel nauseous. Anytime after I would have sex, I'd have a raging migraine and would just feel like so uncomfortable. And funny enough, it wasn't penetrative sex. It was me having like manual sex, like fingering or like oral sex to some extent. I would still feel incredibly uncomfortable and my whole body would tighten and I'd feel, which is so funny because if you've experienced like pleasure-filled, healthy sex, having an orgasm is normally a really like tension-releasing experience and you mm-hmm. often feel really calm afterwards. And if you've had a really stressful week, it's kind of like, oh, thank God. Like I feel like so much of my tension just got released. And it would be the opposite. Like my neck would hurt, my back would hurt. I would just feel like tension in my body coming all the way. It felt like everything was kind of tensing to the core of me. So my neck would tense down, my shoulders would tense in, my like vaginal canal would tense in. So everything just felt tense to like the core of my being. And essentially it's your body trying to protect you from that fear. And it's your body saying, no, that's a scary thing to happen. So I'm going to try to and kind of come back into my shell a little bit. And it's incredibly common for survivors of sexual abuse. It's less talked about for survivors of religious trauma, but it is pretty common for survivors of religious trauma because that shit gets in your head and you become so convinced that sex is the worst thing that could ever happen. And it can literally result in actual physical symptoms. And the scary part about that is when you're trained and trained and trained and trained and trained, and in my opinion, brainwashed to some extent, that sex is bad and sex is evil, unless it's in a marriage, your body sometimes can't decipher that. And so even if you're in a marriage and you're having sex, you can still exhibit vaginismus because your body is still saying, ah, this is not safe. This is not safe. This is bad. We're going to get in trouble. And it retreats and it retracts. And so when I was in a relationship that was really sexually unsafe, I would have headaches and symptoms and it would hurt every time I had sex. And then when I got into a relationship that was safe and felt comfortable and I felt okay, first time we ever did anything sexually, I was amazed. And I had already kind of grieved that, because that was my first sexual relationship, was my abusive sexual relationship. So I had kind of grieved sex. I thought, oh, sex is just going to be awful and it's going to be painful. And I had this relationship after that was a safer relationship. I felt comfortable and I was like, oh my God, wait, can I have like sexual like interactions with someone and not have a raging headache and not feel gross afterwards and feel nauseous and tense and icky? And I talked to my partner about it and he was like, oh yeah, like you probably had vaginismus. And I don't know how the hell he knew what that was, but he said it like it was like the most like well-known thing in the world. And I Googled it and was like, oh my gosh, like that's why sex was so uncomfortable for me and felt so just awkward and tense and unsafe. And it can quite literally cause physical symptoms.
That is so wild. As you've been describing this, I was on a road trip once with a coworker, and I don't know how we landed on the topic of sex, but she was describing to me that she had been with her partner for 20 some odd years. She was older than me, and that they almost never had sex because it was incredibly painful. And that she was like so tight, he could barely get in her. And so like, they just didn't even try. And so she had just like, you know, come to the conclusion that, you know, sex just wasn't a thing for them. And I was like, you should probably go to a doctor about this. And she was like, I don't know. I'm afraid they're going to tell me that it's something serious. And
No. So that's one of the things that's one of the things. So I do want to clarify, you can exhibit symptoms of vaginismus in a safe relationship. So say that you were abused or have trauma or have something prior to that relationship, and then you try to enter a new relationship that's really safe and accepting and consent filled and it's great and healthy, you can still have symptoms of vaginismus because it's just your body reacting to the trauma that you've experienced previously. And so for one, I would encourage any partner of someone who has vaginismus, if you know that it's something from their past, like have a lot of patience with them, because any type of anger or reaction or like negative response to that, if you're already feeling unsafe in your body and someone lashes out at you for that, it's just going to make you retreat even more and retract even more into your shell. And then furthermore, like you can go to like your OBGYN or your gynecologist, or there are sex therapists that you can go to and learn sex techniques and learn how to do pelvic exercises to release your pelvic floor and have more enjoyable sex and release that tension. There were some studies, I heard this from my support. I was in a sexual assault support group when I was in college, because I was sexually assaulted when I was 15 and then again when I was 18. And my sexual assault support group leader was like, there are some women who have literally had their like Kegel muscle, if you've ever heard of Kegels, like doing like Kegel exercises, which is like the internal muscle. There are some people who have had their Kegel muscle like retracted for years, and it's so tensed up because they have so much trauma that their body is not letting them release it. Because trauma, you hold trauma in your body. Like a lot of survivors of sexual abuse hold so much trauma in their hips and in their pelvic floors, and it can drastically impact your sex life, your menstrual cycle, your general feeling of comfort. Like it impacts a lot of things. Because I think people often think that their emotions and their body are more disconnected than they are, and they're not. Like if you can notice that if you have a really stressful week, your menstrual cycle, your period can be pushed back by 2 weeks, and it can literally just be your stress and your body reacting to stress. And so people don't quite understand trauma can do a number and a half on your body. Like it can really mess you up. And I experienced vaginismus when I was going through my sexual assault trial. For context, I was raped in college when I was 18, while I was unconscious, and I reported it to my university. My university was a Christian university. I then went through a really traumatic investigation process of trying to unpack that, and because they were a Christian university, they handled it quite poorly, and it was a lot of purity culture ingrained in the investigation. And so coming out of that, I was experiencing, because of all the trauma, my hair was falling out in clumps, like looked like I was experiencing like chemotherapy symptoms, where I'd be showering and I'd like have a handful of my hair. My face was full of acne. I had like certain patches of acne I couldn't get. I've never had problems with acne. And I had like acne all over my face. I had horrible back problems. Migraines really bad to the point where I would like be sobbing because my head hurt so bad. My appetite was gone. My period was totally messed up. I was having super bad cramps. It was really irregular. Like all these different things that I was having really bad, like nightmares. It was like impacting my sleep. It was insane. And it was literally all rooted back to that. And once I got into like really intensive therapy and started like going processing, pretty much everything went away. I was having seizures. It was like, my body was just like, we're experiencing trauma, like help. And the second I started going through therapy, and obviously for some people, it's not like I go through therapy and then it's gone. But your body reacts really intensely to trauma.
There's, so I'm actually reading a book about this right now. I say reading, I listen to books. I don't read books. I think that you would really love this. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Oh my God. It's the trauma Bible. It's the trauma Bible. I'll plug my podcast. I did a 3-episode series arc reviewing this book and explaining it and doing like a review.
You're the one I heard about it from. You're the one. I forgot. So every time I go home, it's like a 10-hour drive. So I listen to an audiobook on my way, and I opened up my Audibles and the book was there, and I had downloaded it or purchased it or whatever that terminology is for that. But I hadn't listened to it yet. And I was like, when did I do that? I don't know. I guess I'll play it. And so I started playing
during our podcast.
I think I downloaded it immediately after our podcast. And oh my God, it is mind-blowing, the stuff that you learn about how trauma can change your body, it can change your brain, it is amazing the depth of impact that trauma can have on the body. It is absolutely
unreal. The other one I'll plug too is if you're looking to get some more insight into how specifically sexual assault impacts people. Because I think that people read about sexual assault and they see it in the news and they hear that their friends have gone through it, but not a lot of people who haven't actually gone through it themselves understand like the depth of the situation and how much it impacts someone. The book Know My Name by Chanel Miller is phenomenal. If you heard of the Brock Turner case, the Stanford swimmer who raped a girl while she was unconscious at Stanford. It was a huge global case. He got off with like 3 months probation. It was an absolute nightmare. She was Jane Doe for a really long time. So she was known as Jane Doe. She did not release her identity. And she was put like on like Times Women of the Year and stuff as Jane Doe. And then she finally came out and released her identity and released this book detailing her entire experience. And it is unreal. Like it is, Body Keeps Score and Know My Name are like my top two books. Like I recommend them to everyone. I have so many notes in both of them. Like the books are just destroyed with like my handwriting, like doing notations on everything. The Body Keeps Score is fantastic for like any type of trauma because they go through like incest, rape, war violence, like losing a sibling. Like, it's everything. And then, Know My Name is specific to like how sexual violence, like really drastically impacts someone. So even if you're a survivor of sexual violence, like it can be a triggering book to read, but it also, I've never felt more heard and like understood than reading that book because she's talking about a campus assault. And like, that's what I went through. And I was just reading it, like sobbing and being like, oh my God, I've never felt more seen than when reading this book. So that's another fantastic one that I like really enjoyed.
I'll definitely have to check that out too. Now I'm not quite done with The Body Keeps the Score yet because it's a long it's a long book. I am more than halfway. So it's also a lot to process. I actually found myself having to take some breaks after some of the like intense chapters and just like let my brain soak up what I had just taken in because it's a lot. There's a lot of like medical jargon in it. But it's also just like, it's just so heavy. It's so heavy.
Yeah. It's dense as fuck, like material wise. Like I kept reiterating that the reason why I broke it down in my podcast was, for one, because not everyone has access to it. And I think it's, to me, like how Christians view the Bible, like that's how I view this book. I think anyone who's experienced trauma should have access to it. And so for me, it was like, I want to pull a mission. You know how missionaries will go out and throw Bibles out of helicopters? It's like, let me do that with this book. Yeah. So I did a podcast basically breaking down the main points of it. Because for one, it's incredibly dense. And also, if you're really, if you're still like in the thick of your healing journey, it can be super triggering. And it was released in 2014. And unfortunately, trigger warnings were not quite as common. And so there are no trigger warnings. There are absolutely no trigger warnings in the entire book. And that can be incredibly hard. And so I broke it down into like three sections. And then didn't read the book. I just kind of gave my points that I felt like I really resonated with. And then I gave trigger warnings because it was like, I did the same thing. I had to read it in chunks and then have to like take, I literally would take a break and I'd like journal and I'd organize notes for the podcast because I knew I was going to be doing a podcast about it. And then I'd like wait a week and then start again and try to read it. Cause it was like, there was anyone who reads that and like one sitting has to be absolutely unhinged. Like props to you, but I had to like really take a moment because it's a lot.
Oh yeah. And that, you know, he uses a lot of actual stories in it too, which I mean, mm-hmm. would be important for trigger warnings because some of them were pretty intense. So
yeah, definitely.
Incredible book. And I really feel like I have learned so much already and I can't wait to actually finish it so that I can really see how it wraps up in the end, but absolutely incredible book. Yeah. I'm really glad you told me about it.
Yeah, no, I love it. I wave that flag. Like I'm like, please read this book. It's fantastic. And I was even waving the flag before I read it because I had so many therapists recommend it to me. And then I finally was like, okay, Fina, you got to stop recommending this fucking book to people before you actually read it. Like you have to read it. So then I read it and I was like, oh no, I'm recommending it. It's fantastic.
I've actually ordered it for my mom and sent it to her because my mom had a lot of childhood trauma, in many forms. And I'm going to leave it at that because it's not my story to tell. And I don't know how much she wants revealed. She is actually dealing with health issues in her adult life now, where so often doctors are like, we're really not sure why this is happening to you. And the last chapter that I finished of the book was where they were talking about how childhood trauma that goes left untreated can actually cause specific health issues that can go like without explanation in your adult life. And like half the ones he listed that were possible are the ones that my mom's dealing with. Yeah. And I was like, I really think that two things. One, you need to read this book. And two, you need a therapist like I've been telling you for the past 2 years, Mom. But I can't make her do what she doesn't want to do. So, but I feel like
it would be really valuable. And even routing back to the shame aspect of it too, with trauma and shame, trauma is... often people feel that their own trauma is really shameful. And unfortunately, like, I think we've only had maybe a revival is such a religious word, but I think we've kind of had this like mental health revival in culture where we're starting to actually acknowledge that trauma isn't just war vets, although that is incredibly traumatic, but that trauma holds a lot of different forms. And one of the reasons why I started the podcast and started the blog and actually like post on social media, because the way that I kind of started all of it was like on my personal account, I just started like posting a ton about my sexual assault. And almost every post I had was like, I've learned this in my healing journey. I'm coping with this. And one of the reasons why I did that was just no one was talking about it. And it happened at a religious school, and I did a podcast. This is only the second podcast I've been a guest on. Funny enough, I've done almost 50 episodes of my own podcast, but I've only been a guest on two of them. And the first one that I was on was called A Queer Guide to a Christian College. And it was a individual who went to my college who was interviewing people from my college and processing, like, hey, like, how did you deal with being in this school that is openly homophobic and has a lot of sexist and misogynistic principles and, like, ethical pillars that they stand on? And they interviewed me about my sexual assault. And I was still at the school at the time, which is a really tricky situation to be in because I'm like, how do I say enough without getting, like, expelled or, like, get in trouble? And one of the things I mentioned was, like, there's kind of this culture of sexual assault happens, but it doesn't happen at this school. And that's not accurate. And once I started talking about it and uncapping kind of the bottle of shame, I guess, and kind of there's a Brené Brown quote. Brené Brown is a great resource for shame as well. She has some religious roots, but she's fantastic when it comes to shame. She has some stuff that she talks about referencing, like, that shame thrives in darkness, and that when you don't talk about the things that you feel shameful about, it festers and it eats you alive, and you feel so alone and you don't understand how it could have happened to you. And the second that I started to talk about it and post about it and be kind of unintentionally, I kind of became like the poster child for sexual assault at this college. And my DMs were just like filling up with people DMing me and texting me and saying, hey, this happened to me at this college. Hey, I had this experience. Hey, I even went through the report and the investigation at this college. And I swear to you, you ask anyone at that college, hey, has a sexual assault happened here? Most people are going to be like, I've never heard of one, because it's just such a hush-hush thing. And it's such a small school and it's so religious that it's not going to make the newspapers. Like, if there's a big sexual assault, it's not going to go anywhere. And so once I started talking about it, I kind of unintentionally became this resource. But then I started posting about it on my blog and writing blog pieces about it. And then I started writing poetry about it. And then once I did the podcast, like, my second podcast episode was like an hour long, basically like unpacking and very like never before told kind of story of the entirety of my survivor story. And I kind of became this resource for people for sexual assault, which is a blessing and a burden to some extent. And there, I definitely had to step back to some extent and be like, I've put myself in a position where now I'm someone's resource for the trauma that I'm still unpacking. And there's only so much I can do for other people while I'm still trying to process and not trigger myself. But it's amazing what talking about it can do. And I also want to clarify that talking about it is not for everybody. I think people sometimes hear that and they think, oh, I'm a failure if I don't speak about my trauma. And if I don't go and blast it from the rooftops and write a book about it, or, like, you know, then I'm failing. And it's like, no, you can process it how you want to. But even telling close friends your experience and just in telling people, hey, this is what happened to me, it's amazing how that can release a lot of tension and fear and shame. And be careful who you share your story with, because, you know, if you share it with the wrong people, then you can have a really bad experience. But if you share it with people who you know are people that you can trust and people who are empathetic and who have given you reasons to think that they are worthy of your story, it can be a really freeing experience, and shame doesn't thrive in that environment.
Absolutely. Yep. That was in that whole train of thought was in one of Brené Brown's books, where she talks about, you know, shining light on it so that it can't thrive, but then also be careful who you tell, you know, it has to be someone you trust. She actually has there's a term she has for it, marble friends. They have to be marble friends. I love Brené Brown too. I've read three of her books.
I think
listen to three of
the books. Might be, I thought it was just me, but it wasn't. There's one book that she has. I'm trying to read it off of my bookshelf. But no, 100%. So much of those points that I just made, my support group, we had a whole, like two weeks on Brené Brown, where it was like, we watched her Netflix special. We went through all of her quotes and we're like, here are all these quotes on shame and trauma and like how to process and bravery and what courage means and all these different things. We had a full 2 weeks of our curriculum that was just like, and it's Brené week. Now we're just going to cycle through all of this, but she's fantastic.
She is fantastic. And I actually love that she can have the position that she does and still have her own healthy relationship with God. I think that that's great for her, because I think that for a lot of people, it's challenging for them to have both. So.
Yeah. So. Well, and she's also a great example to people who are religious. Like, here's how to do it in a way that is healthy, in a way that doesn't discriminate against people and ostracize people and traumatize people. Like, she has her beliefs and she also is incredibly respectful and open and empathetic and loving towards people who don't have the same experience as her. And you don't find that a lot in mainstream religious figures. You might find that in someone in like your small church that maybe is a really kind and warm-hearted person, but someone who has that much of a platform, that's not a super common thing to find. No. And she does it really well.
No, usually you see them wield that type of influence and power for the negative. Ugh.
Yeah.
Makes me feel gross thinking about it, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has been a great episode. How long are we at? Are we at like 45-ish minutes?
41.
41. Okay. Well, is there anything else that you want to talk about? Anything else that we should cover before we wrap this up?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I would just say, like, I think the one thing that I learned a lot in my personal journey was, and this has been said so many times, especially because, like we mentioned, there has been kind of this like resurgence and like revival of mental health and actually taking care of yourself and treating trauma as a legitimate condition. With that also has come kind of the like mainstream mental health aspect as well, where things have almost been, now there are things that seem cliche and there are things that seem like they've kind of been beat to death, where it's like, give yourself grace, like be your best friend, and like healing isn't linear. And the thing is all of those things are incredibly true, but because they've just been said so many times on every fucking social media infographic on every mental health Instagram page ever, they don't have as much weight. And it sounds cheesy, but like giving yourself grace and being kind to yourself while healing is incredibly important. And I think the thing that people have that I've had a hard time with is I grew up in an environment that was incredibly shameful and that slapped me on the hand for a lot of things. And so it is so natural for you to be healing and then kind of slap yourself on the hand every once in a while. That's a really natural reaction because you're trying to break a habit that you've been engaged in for a really long time. And so it's going to be a really natural reaction for you to maybe be going through a healing process. And then maybe you feel like you regress and you're like, oh, slap myself on the hand. Like, damn it. Like I'm doing a bad job. Try to push against that as much as physically possible. And the way that I have kind of done it, because I think you can say like, oh, be kind to yourself. And it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? How do I do that? The way that I've tried to implement like kind of the whole be kind to yourself, give yourself grace, kind of like non-religious doctrine into my life is just holding my inner child really closely, which once again sounds really cliche, but my inner child and myself as a young kid, I experienced so much shame for things I couldn't control. I had mental health problems that I couldn't control. I wasn't emotionally regulating properly because I didn't have the tools. And I experienced so much shame from my household, from the church, from teachers. Like there was so much shame put on a very small young child that didn't know any better and that didn't have any tools to do any better. And so the way that I have this like really intense like love for her and that little version of me, because she didn't know any better and she's scared and she's doing her best. But yet I have this really high expectation for myself now. And so one of the ways that I try to be kind to myself is just anytime I try to like shit on myself for not being good enough or shame myself or kind of push myself back into that like cave of shame where I feel alone and isolated, is to just look at myself as my like 9-year-old self again and be like, okay, if I'm treating myself poorly, I'm treating that 9-year-old girl poorly. And she doesn't deserve that because she has tried her best and she's done everything she can and she doesn't have the tools and she feels alone and she feels isolated. And when I'm sitting there talking bad about myself, I'm talking bad about her. And that's not fair to her. And so that's what I remind myself. And also to surround yourself with people who can remind you of that as well. Because sometimes when you're in that tunnel vision of shame, you can just keep shaming yourself, keep shaming yourself, keep shaming yourself. And sometimes you need like a new voice to break through that. But I think just like giving yourself grace and letting your inner child kind of run free to an extent as well. I've been eating Gushers and chicken nuggets constantly right now because my little inner child, my 9-year-old self, didn't get to do that. And so part of my healing journey and part of my therapy right now has been undoing some of the harm that was done to her by giving myself grace and giving myself freedom to play and to be a child again, even as an adult. And it might seem silly and it might not be the most mainstream or socially accepted way of healing, but like, it doesn't fucking matter. Like, do what makes you heal and what makes you feel safe and what makes you feel seen and heard. And if that doesn't fit into like social standards, like fuck it, like who cares? Just try to give yourself grace and know that this might take a while. If you've been raised in the church for 25 years, it could take 25 years to unpack. It could take longer. Like, it's going to be a while. Yeah, but little steps and giving yourself grace and trying to refrain from slapping yourself on your hand when you can do a lot.
You gave me goosebumps and almost made me cry.
I almost cried last time you were my own inner child, and I was like, oh, I love her. She's so tiny and she deserves the world.
That is actually a really beautiful perspective that I have never taken myself. I've never looked at it that way. Which is why it almost brought me to tears, was because those are just really profound words. I think that we forget that we are still like the product of our experiences and that the childhood us is an extension of us. It's still us. And yeah, the child that we were went through what it went through with almost no tools. Because we're not born knowing what we need to know to make it in life. We're supposed to learn that. And when you're in a situation where you're never taught those tools, but you're put through the trauma that you're put through,
you're in survival
mode. God bless the little me for making it.
Yeah, you're in survival mode and you do what you can to survive. And honestly, like, I don't hold my little self accountable for that. She's a baby. I hold my adult self accountable because I have the resources and I have the tools now. And if I fuck up as an adult, there's difference between, I still give myself grace, but I still hold myself accountable. And I say, that wasn't the best emotional response. Like, we need to rethink this. We need to talk about this. We need to be humble. But little Fina, that little like 9-year-old girl who maybe threw a tantrum because she felt unheard or felt isolated, or maybe she was really angry and did things that she regrets. Like, she was a baby. And that's the other thing is I often refer to myself, honestly, like 18 was when my healing journey started. And that's when I started going to therapy and started seeking out resources and stuff. So below 18, I refer to myself as a baby. I don't ever refer to myself as like a teenager. It's always like, no, like baby Fina, like did what she could. And I've also gone back and tried to make amends for that. Like, I've apologized to people for things that I did when I was a child. And that's all you can do. You can try to make amends. You can try to take responsibility, but like, you holding that over your own head and beating the shit out of yourself for the rest of your life, like, that little version of yourself has already gone through so much. Do you think that they deserve being just chastised for it on top of that? Like, they don't deserve that. And so that's the only way that you can try to heal too, is to try to let the little version of yourself heal too. And that was something that I had a therapist for a year. She was only my therapist for a year. And that was one of the things that she said to me. And she was this like 80-year-old Christian woman. And I was talking badly about myself. And she said, would you ever talk to little Serafina like that? Do you think she deserves that? And I was so taken aback and felt so naked and vulnerable. And I was just like, I shut down. I was like, oh God, like, I don't want to talk about that. Like, I just totally shut down. And it took me a good 4 years after that therapy session to actually finally come to terms with the inner child thing. But I called her, I called that therapist 3 days ago and called her, and I haven't talked to her in like 5 years. And I was like, hey, like, that changed the course of my life. Like, that altered the course of my life was you saying that. It stuck with me forever. I have been processing it for 5 years, and I pushed it out of my mind for a good chunk of time. And I just recently kind of started to really get in and unpack it. And like, thank you. And she was like, and we talked for like an hour on the phone, like talking about things. And she was like checking in on, she was like, well, little Fina didn't deserve that. She's a precious little baby. And I was like, she is a precious little baby. And we just had that conversation literally 3 days ago. So give your little self grace.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What a beautiful way to wrap up this episode. I love it. I absolutely love it. I could talk with you on this topic. I could just talk with you for hours.
We could talk for a long time.
We could. We'll have to collaborate again. I think it'll be great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining me. I think that this was a wonderful collaboration. I'll definitely have you on again. And if you want me on, I'd love to be on your episode.
Oh my God.
As well.
Anytime. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I hope that everyone had a wonderful time, that they learned as much as I did. And most importantly, if you are out there and you're struggling with shame and trauma, you're not alone. I hope that this makes you feel heard and seen. Reach out to someone close and trustworthy. Share your story. And
you can always DM me. Feel free to DM me and talk about it. My Instagram is @SerafinaBlog, SERAFINA blog. Feel free to DM me. My email's there. If you need to talk about it and vent and have someone listen to you and actually validate your experiences, I would also always encourage a therapist, but I'm more than welcome I'm more than willing to listen and hear you out as well.
Check the show notes for links to all that is Serafina. So we'll have them there. Thanks so much. And we will, You'll hear from me again next week. All right. Bye-bye. That was great.